Hello, everybody, and welcome to Talking Flutes with me, the old flute geezer from London Town, Jean-Paul Wright. And you never guess who we got today. Who we got today? Another flutey. No, we ain't got a flutey. We've got the one and only Steve Cole, saxophone player, saxophone teacher, and not only a saxophonist, but also a doctor. So a very educated guy, which is more than I am. I'm not an educated geezer. I'm just an old flutey-tootie player that plays knock blobs on sticks on a piece of paper. Hello, Steve, and welcome to Talking Flutes.
How's it going, JP? What an intro.
Yeah, sorry, me old fruit. I just got to give it a bit of pizzazz and all that.
Absolutely.
And yeah, sorry about that. I should have taken it slightly more serious because it was you, but...
No, please don't. Please don't.
Now, I know this is a flute podcast, but the reason why we've asked you to come on is, as I briefly mentioned before I switched the on button, being a flute player myself, when I have those things such as improv come up on a score, or if I'm trying to do something to put out that is improvisational, I run a mile. I don't know what to do. Mm. And then when I see players like you that gel every time that you play, because you're never playing in the same setting on every day, on every occasion. You have to gel with a different group at different times.
Yeah.
Because you're quite prolific with your albums. A lot of those you've taken inspiration from events that have been going on at that time. So I think the aim of today is to give us flute players a contra view from the cool dudes. The cool, well... Okay, I'll give you a classic example here, Steve.
Are you going to call one of those guys? Because I'd like to talk to one of them too.
I'll give you an example, okay? You have a line of flutes laying on a table. A flute player will come over and they'll look at the name on the flute first and then they'll pick it up and they'll play it. And largely, and sorry for those flute players who don't do this, largely they've already prejudged what it's going to sound like. My experience with horn players is you guys just pick the horn up first. You don't give a monkey's what's written on it. You just pick it up and then you play it and then you look.
That's about right. Well, first of all, saxophones, you know, for the longest time, and this has changed, but for the longest time, it didn't matter what it said on it because they were all so inconsistent that, you know, you could have one that has an S and one that has a Y and one that has another Y. And there's no judging the label because it's really just what the instrument is, you know, and you could try, you know, 10 of one brand of or maker of saxophone and they're all going to be completely different, you know, and I think that's where that all started. And like I say, I think that's gotten much better. I think that the more established makers have been forced to have a more consistent product because of some of the competitors who have come around to challenge them, who have very, very consistent products. But yeah, I think that's a lot of where it comes from. And plus, it's just this curiosity. It's like we're saxophone players. It's like there's just all these little things that we listen for. And it's like we're always looking for that ultimate thing. And it's like, ooh, is this going to be it? Is this going to be the one? Is that going to be the one? You know, so I think it's just like curiosity, but also we're just conditioned to believe that there's no such thing as judging a book by its cover.
Well, I love that term, curiosity, because without that curiosity, music becomes very sterile, very note-driven and very linear, almost a mathematical equation, which I suppose in essence, that's what music is. However, what I want to explore to you today is how horn players take this mathematical equation, which is the note, and you expand it. It's almost like a time warp because you very rarely play that one note. As we would say a crotchet, you would play around with that to give it life. Mm-hmm. And for flute players, but not only flute players, but those outside the jazz field, whether it be smooth, contemporary or traditional jazz, whatever jazz, there's so many types of genres within jazz, I think we could learn a lot from understanding that the length and the gap of each note will predetermine almost the life of that sound.
Sure. It's interesting because I am a classical musician as well, and actually been doing a lot of classical playing. You know, I find that it's all about kind of the bandwidth that you have to play with, right? I mean, in more classical styles, the bandwidth is a bit more narrow. You know, you can't necessarily decide that you're going to approach a note, you know, that's written in a piece of music meant to be played a certain way and decide that you're just going to throw, you know, some notes around it or, you know, just to kind of maybe slide into it with, you know, some kind of hip, you know, little nuance. But that doesn't mean that a note has any less mystery to it or possibility around it. It just means that the latitude you have to create that is narrower. Now, in jazz, sometimes it's overwhelming how much latitude you have, and to the point where, you know, if you're not careful, it could be almost paralyzing because it's just like, I can do anything I want, so where the heck do I start, you know? And I think that's where we start to develop, you know, kind of that elusive voice. It allows us to experiment within a broader range of possibility. But at the end of the day, the goal is to actually put that through a funnel and figure out who we are as a player and what our voice is and how that voice manifests in the choices that we make, given the bandwidth that's available to us. And I think that, you know, is still available. I mean, you can hear the difference in the classical world between players. Very much so. And I think it's the same thing with jazz. It's just we just have a little bit more license to, I don't know, make mistakes. to experiment and to, you know, fail famously. And, you know, I just look at it as just how much room do you have?
Tell me about the process of finding your voice, because that is the same in any communication to an audience, whether it be verbal or whether it be with an instrument. How do we sort of go about locating that unique us?
Yeah. I mean, and so that's the big challenge, right? I mean, that's the goal. You want someone to eventually come up to you and say, anytime I hear you play, I know it's you. And why is that? Because there's something, it's almost like if you, I hear your voice, I know it's you when you speak. You hear my voice, you know it's me. We find a cadence, we find the inflection, we find the passion that we, instill into our communication. And I think it's the same thing with music and with playing. I've always started with inspiration. I start with, you know, exemplars in inspiration. Everybody starts out sounding like somebody and it's usually not themselves, right? And, you know, you choose these different aspects from others playing that inspires you, that gives you some spark. And I think we all start out sounding very derivative. The trick is to kind of start to experiment and bring your own point of view into your playing. And I think there's this tipping point. Like, for instance, I loved, you know, Michael Brecker, you know, and so I would listen to his sound and I would listen to his approach and listen to, you know, all the little subtle things that he did to make it sound like him. And I would try to do those things because they were so inspiring. I thought they were so cool and I wanted to sound like that. There comes a point where you're focusing so much of your energy on trying to be somebody else that you realize this is way too hard. I'm never going to be that person. It's like living your entire life doing an impression of somebody else. And I think that it's almost like the frustration of that's never going to happen that kind of leads you to say, you know what, I need to find what I'm going to do with this. It's almost like, you know, you can make a paella from a recipe book a million times and it will resemble a paella. But if you eat it over and over again and you're like, I don't know what's up with this. It's always too salty. Well, then use less salt, right? I don't really like mussels. Well, then put something else in it. Nothing says that you have to follow the instructions. You can actually use your own tastes and preferences, the things that drive you, the things that constitute meaning for you. You can add those ingredients and you can also take some things away that may not really be, you know, who you are. And I think it's very much the same process in finding your voice on an instrument.
So how have you seen your voice develop? Obviously, as you get older, you have more experiences, and those experiences you can put into what you're playing and what you're feeling. How has it sort of developed?
I think the more experience you have, I mean, at the end of the day, I always feel like I want to feel comfortable. I want to feel comfortable when I'm playing. I don't want to work that hard. I want to feel like my technique is allowing me to push past the mechanics and manifest what I'm actually feeling in the moment, right? How do I want to interpret this? What kind of an impact do I want to make by playing this phrase? And I think how it's changed is that, A, the more you listen, the more you learn, the more you experience, the more your point of view changes. Absolutely. Here's just a simple example. Like when you're young, especially in the jazz world, you feel like, you know, my job is to, you know, play not for the audience, but for all the other saxophone players in the room, right? My job is to make you, you know, believe that I'm awesome, right? And then later on, you believe that's not your job. You know, your job is to make somebody feel something. And even that change of perspective, it's just like, it's not about me. It's about you, really. It's about the audience. It's about making an impression. It's about communicating something meaningful. That in and of itself is going to change how you communicate on your instrument, i.e. your voice changes because your intentionality is different. What you're trying to accomplish is different. That's one aspect of how your voice evolves. The other is you get better at it. You get better at your instrument and you're able to surmount so many of the mechanical and technical challenges that maybe were, you know, stifling, you know, you bringing your voice forward, and you become able to, again, manifest much more of what you intend because you're just more comfortable on your instrument. You figured out how to make it do the stuff you want it to do.
Well, I've been lucky enough to see you play quite a few times. And one of a memorable one was in Pizza Express in London for me, because it's such an intimate venue, very closed, and the acoustics are quite sort of dead. So it's almost as though you're working, you're having to work yourself.
Oh, yeah.
But you seem very free in that environment, and you're very, the way that you project your sound is very different in that environment than you would be if it was in a bigger auditorium. But still, nonetheless, you're still concentrating on the musicians you're playing with, but also fully engaged with the audience, because you don't stand still. You're animating what you're playing, which I think is such a big thing for a musician, because the audience is a visual as well, aren't we? As well as auditory.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the interesting thing about, you know, playing in dead rooms, it's advice I got from Kirk Whalum years ago. We were at a festival together. You know, at that time, a lot of saxophone players were bringing out their own effects and things and wanting to recreate that wonderful, resonant, acoustic environment, like playing in a marble room with all the beautiful reverb. And it's just like, oh my God, all I have to do is just, you know, everything sounds beautiful. And Kirk went up there with a microphone with nothing, no reverb in the monitors, no gear. And I asked him, like, how come, like you're not using any reverb? And he's like, man, if I can make that monitor as dry as a bone sound good, if my saxophone can sound good through that, I know that I'm doing my, I know that it's sounding great out there. And from that day forward, I was definitely on that same train. When I practice in a dead room. When I'm on stage, I do not have any effects in my monitors at all. I'm focusing so fundamentally on my sound and making the saxophone sound as rich and beautiful and in tune as I can under the most harsh circumstances of dry, no help, no training wheels. And that's part of how I'm able to feel comfortable in a lot of different environments. Because, you know, you play in different venues, everything's going to sound different. And so it's just really focused on, I want to feel comfortable with my sound without any training wheels, without any help. That ability removes a lot of distraction. And I'm able to just play and be comfortable and think about things like, you know, how am I playing? And am I having fun? And am I communicating effectively? You know, it just seems a more natural thing once you take that out of the equation, when you focus on a good sound and a confident sound, regardless of where you are.
So coming from a flute playing perspective, I have a piece of music some music in front of me. I'm playing each note and I'm trying not to concentrate on anything other than in that moment, those notes, that paragraph. But you guys, you're not playing a sheet of music. So every performance you do is every performance is very, very different because you can have different notes in different, you know, different patterns. So when you're playing that, what is actually going through your mind? Or is if nothing, is it just sort of muscle memory and your ears are just going, taking you where you into places that you weren't expecting?
Yeah. In the best of all situations, it is nothing. It's a flow state, right? It's everything all at once. In the best of all worlds, the saxophone feels fantastic. The band sounds fantastic. And you're just simply able to just sing without thinking about anything. And your mind and your body and your instrument are all kind of in this like alignment, and it's beautiful. That doesn't happen every day, you know? Sometimes, and it's really weird. And I think that mindfulness generally is a great tool, you know, to bring the player back into what really matters. And into that moment, into that note, into that phrase, into, you know, making meaning out of what music you're playing. Because the true fact of the matter is that many, many times I'm looking at someone who's yawning in the back row, or I'm, you know, keyed into like, I don't like that guitar tone. What's going on there? Or this reed is about to really let me down. Or, you know, there's a million things like, you know, it's almost like when you can't sleep, right? You can't sleep because there's a thousand things going through your mind. And if you're just able to quiet those things and just focus, it's like, I'm going to turn off the switch and actually sleep. You actually can fall asleep, right? And so for me, again, in the best of all worlds, nothing is going through my mind and I'm just in the moment. Other times I'm very distracted and I have to literally have a conversation with myself while still playing and entertaining that says, hey, get back to what's important here.
And how do you find the creative juices sort of pour out in occasions like that? Obviously, if you're in the moment, it's just there and there's this extra power that's taking you into other places because you're gelling with the musicians, you're gelling with the environment and the audience. When you get that gut that things aren't necessarily going right, how do you still get that musical creativity in your performance?
That's when brute force comes in. That's when all of the freaking work that you've done in the practice room comes in, and you literally are just, you're relying on your technique and your experience. I've played shows from top to bottom that, you know, something just didn't feel right on the saxophone, mostly reed related, very rarely saxophone related. Mostly reed related. I mean, those things are the devil. I mean, whoever invented reeds, man, we need to have a conversation about that whole thing. Because, I mean, you know, ask any wind player who uses, I mean, they'll make or break you sometimes. So I'll have reed issues and I'll be like, you know, this horn is not feeling, I'm not having a good time. I'm struggling. I'm having to use every little bit of energy that I have just to sound competent, right? And it's, you know, and then people will come up, oh my God, what an amazing show. And I'm like, are you out of your mind? But at the end of the day, you know, that's where, you know, you rely on your training. You rely on your skills to make it look easy, even when it's absolutely not. So that's the only answer I have. It's brute force.
Well, that actually, that brute force, I love that. That leads, I'm very aware that I haven't actually asked you any of the questions that have been sent in by our listeners. So that leads in nicely. We're talking about brute force, and I can only talk about brute force because I actually love scales and scalic studies. But what is the role? I know that goes against a lot of people that find it very boring and sort of very an awful waste of time. But what is the role of scales and modes in saxophone improvisation? And how do you learn to use them effectively?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, in some respects, scales play the same role in jazz as they do in classical music. Yeah. In one aspect, they help us to develop a familiarity and a comfort level with all the different key structures of our instrument and demystify the instrument itself. We're able to, with fluency, play through scale-related exercises. We're mastering the instrument in some respects. Keys don't become hard or easy. They just become different tonal centers where you have the same facility no matter what key you're in. You know, I mean, guitar players have this lovely thing where all they got to do is move their finger down the fret and they're at a different key. We actually have to navigate through an entire different key structure. But the other thing is it demystifies improvisation in and of itself. You know, starts out as a math problem, yeah. Right? I mean, you have a chord structure and you have chord tones, and then you have notes and scales that are appropriate to, you know, those chords and those chord changes. And then you have, you know, voice leading between chords. And there are certain, you know, there are certain available tensions and there are certain unavailable tensions, right? And again, then it gets pretty subjective from there. But, you know, often with students, I'm just like, you know, write out the chord tones. And all of a sudden, all these chord changes become very demystified because now you have like the building blocks of melody. And instead of playing, you know, you can actually see that there are melodies reveal themselves as you look and see how you're going to get from one chord to the next without making a big, you know, interval jump, right? So, you know, that's one thing. But I think at the end of the day, I started out as a classical musician. That's where most of my training has been. And I looked at scales and exercises as a necessary element of developing my comfort and mastery of the instrument. In jazz, they're the roadmap to navigating the possibilities in different harmonies, knowing what key you are in and what scales are appropriate. And it's basically just here's a box of possibilities. Yeah. But then the hard part comes because, you know, when I learned all that stuff, the first thing I did when I tried to actually improvise was forget all about it, you know, because I found myself just, you know, playing, thinking so much. And, you know, I really think improvisation is so much more about learning and absorbing and, again, becoming inspired and forming your own ideas about what possible melodies are available to you within a chord structure. And I talk to a lot of other players who are, you know, we talk to each other about like, well, so what do you think about when you're playing, when you're improvising? And some of them will be like, well, you know, it's almost like I'm reading the Matrix. Okay, I know what chord it is. I know what kind of modes are available. I know what kind of scales are available. I know what chord tone I want to approach this chord with. I know what chord tone I want to leave that chord change and where I want to land on the next one. And they're like, what do you think about it? And I think about, I just want to play something that sounds cool to me. And most of my improvisation education was, you know, learning from others and walking in the shoes. So transcribing constantly, it was like one of my biggest adventures in saxophone playing was just constantly transcribing. It's almost like finding your voice through understanding the voices of others. And through that, I just started to, you know, hear my way through chords because I had so much experience with how other people played their way through chord changes. So yeah, it's a long and convoluted answer to a very simple question. I hope I answered it.
more than answered it. And
Steve. Yeah.
No, absolutely not. Because it leads me on to, again, another sub question is you're transcribing that out. So you're learning the dots and you're learning where they go within the chord structures. But there gets to a point where you've got to break free of the self-limiting factors that a classical player has within. And the breaking free on improvisation is probably the biggest thing that is holding people back, certainly in the flute field. I'm not sure about sax field because it's almost though you're built to be free. How would a classical musician sort of take the chains off, take those classical chains off and just allow themselves just to go for it?
Well, you know, I think there's probably the larger part of the population who are afraid to improvise or don't improvise because they don't think they have the chops to do it. I think for the most part, they're absolutely wrong. I mean, everybody improvises all the time. I mean, we improvise when we speak. I mean, you and I are improvising right now. I don't know what I'm going to say next. I'm just speaking. I have a language. I have a vocabulary, and I'm using it in ways that are not known to me until I hear myself. I mean, if we're just extemporaneous, I mean, obviously we have the ability to plan what we say, or, you know, but we're just, you know, we're reflecting in action, you know, we're in action and it's this constant thing. I think most people just need to try it. You know, you don't have to do it in front of people, but how many times have you sung a song and used some nuance or whistled along with something and played a counter melody? I mean,
yes, yes.
We all have this agency. We all have this ability. And so much of it is just try it, just jump in. One of the things that a lot of people in the business world study jazz musicians for that very thing. Jazz musicians have this, they look at the world of music as just incredible amount of possibility. And there's this tacit belief that no matter what happens, something beautiful is going to emerge. You know, that's why you jump in, play, blow, you know? Get on stage with four people you've never met before, because you all know a bunch of the same songs. You all kind of know the rules of the road. Of course it's going to be cool, you know? I say just try it and give yourself credit for all of the improvisation you've already done. You know, there's a lot of transferable skills here.
Is there a right improv and a wrong improv? I only say that because my only experience in a free jazz club in Prague was I walked in and didn't have the foggiest what was going on, but they all ended a piece at the same time. They may have been smoking or drinking whilst the others were playing, and I couldn't really get what was going on. Is there a right and wrong?
Well, I mean, right and wrong as defined by, you know, idiomatic preconceptions, yep. Sure. You know, if you're going up in a blues club and you start, like, you know, improvising as you would over a figured bass, I mean, that might not be, you know, idiomatically appropriate for the room. And, you know, clearly there are, again, tensions that are available and tensions that are unavailable. But then again, some of those unavailable tensions are very available in certain kinds of music. So, like anything else, it depends. It depends on what the culture of the moment is and what the genre suggests. Jumping in and improvising in public is scary for even the most seasoned. But to not try it because you don't think that you're capable, I think is, you know, you miss every one of the shots you don't take, right? So I think people should step out of their comfort zone. I think they should, you know, just at home, put on a song that you like. Learn the melody and then play accompaniment to it. You know, that's improvising. Interpret a melody in a different way. A theme and variations is an improvisation. Just try it. Get your ear and your mind and your, you know, your heart comfortable with stepping outside of the zone a little bit. I think that the more you are successful, the more you're motivated to even expand your zone, take more risks. And then people might be inspired to, you know, actually, okay, I want to understand a little bit more about, you know, kind of the vocabulary and some of the rules of the road. By then you're hooked, because now you have a contextual reason for exploring the building blocks of harmony and improvisation. But improvising is no different than making up a melody. You know, we have, you know, four chords. Pachelbel's canon is the center of all Western popular music for the last, you know, couple hundred years. You know, just do it. Just try it.
And that breaking free will also enable your ears to develop more finely, because you're having to, instead of focusing on yourself, you're having to listen very carefully, but in a very different context to others.
Absolutely. And that fear is the thing that keeps the focus inward. There's no shame in just, you know, going into a room where no one can hear you and putting on some chords that you like or putting on a song that you like and just playing along with it and trying to see where does your imagination take you. And yeah, listening and being part of what you're doing, not being so self-monitoring, but just like, you know, people who play instruments have superpowers and many of them don't actually allow themselves to unleash them.
I like that. And when you're listening to a track that's got a sax in it, I would imagine because you've developed your sound skills, you can focus in on the bass, you can focus in on the drums, you can focus in on other things to find out what's going on to build the whole. How important is that to be able to not necessarily listen to the lead instrument?
Well, I think it's critical. I mean, especially let's say you're accompanying a vocalist, as you know, you're a melodic instrument, but you know that your job is not to, you know, be the focus of attention. At the end of the day, there's going to be a solo that comes up and, you know, you have to have been listening to the chord structure and the meter and all of the interplay between instruments and the style and the intention of the vocalist in order to play something that's, you know, that makes sense contextually. But also there's so much inspiration from listening to how the rhythm section interprets chord changes. You know, pianists and guitar players and bass players, even drummers will telegraph these beautiful suggestions. I mean, there's so many melodic possibilities that are just offered to you through the normal goings-on of a rhythm section playing together. And I often talk about that. It's like, well, I don't know what notes to play. It's like, well, have you been listening? Did you see how the pianist played just a little pattern that to between these two chords? It was so beautiful. If you were paying attention to that, that's a bit of vocabulary that you just learned, you know? So listening broadly is critical, absolutely.
Being aware of the creative input from others is sort of key, which leads me on to a question from a Claire Short from Manchester, UK, who says, I am so pleased you've got Steve on. I'm a flute player, but love jazz. And I've seen Steve in the States play. Shouldn't say where. But her question is, Steve, you've made many records. How does the creative seed initially show itself? And how do you make that grow into the final album?
There's not a whole lot of rhyme or reason. But I can say for the most part, the creative seed is started through collaboration. I'm most inspired as a songwriter when I'm collaborating with another songwriter. I love hearing things that I would have never thought of because when I hear someone's maybe nugget of an idea, it opens up my mind to things that I would have never thought of or heard in my own head had I not been inspired by this thing that is not of me, right? And so a lot of my albums are collaborative. There are also times where I'll originate something because, I don't know, sometimes, you know, you just hear things. You know, I like to listen to a lot. When I'm making records, when I'm in an album cycle, I like to just start listening to so much music. Pop music, R&B, funk, classical music. I mean, everything. Because there are these things that will land on you, especially because in an album cycle, I'm so keenly aware of listening so deeply to things that are interesting. And they're like, wow, that is so cool. I feel like I want to take that and develop that into something, you know, different, even if it's has nothing to do with it, right? But then I'll take it and sometimes it'll just work its way out in my own brain. But then other times I'll actually share that with somebody else and say, hey, where would you take this? Where would you go with this? And, you know, sometimes they'll take it in a direction. It's like, not so much. And other times it'll be something, again, that I would have never thought of. So I think it's just listening with a different kind of mindset, but also being really open to collaboration with others that really starts the ball rolling.
So what would you class as a narrative to a nugget? Would it be, I suppose it's very different for each piece you choose, but if you start with something that jumps out, as you say, just sort of jumps out into your head, or you just get this sound or whatever it is, does it then form itself into a sort of an audible narrative or a written narrative that you can then develop thought process, writing down, not necessarily with notes, but sort of writing down a story.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if I'm understanding the question correctly, I mean, sometimes there'll be something inspiring that I'll actually need to work out. So, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about the tools we have. I'll sit in where I am now, which is in my studio, and I'll you know, if it's a melodic idea, I'll play it in, listen to it over and over and over again, try to hear a chord structure that might emerge.
Okay.
And therein lies a number of possibilities. I mean, one melody's character can change fundamentally simply by the harmony that surrounds it. But also then there's feel and there's groove. And then there's, you know, what mood is this? You know, not mode, but what mood? Is it exciting? Is it introspective? Is it academic? I mean, like, where are we going with this thing? And then, you know, through some experimentation and just inspiration, it starts to develop a bit of a life of its own. And the great thing is that all of this can be done iteratively using, you know, the tools that we have technologically to where you actually have something that you can react to, you know, that you can look at from a number of perspectives because it now exists. It's now audible. And then you can evaluate it and iterate, which is really cool.
And are you ever happy with something, or once you released it and you're listening back, do you ever think, I'd just like to tweak that? Or
yeah, I mean, I could listen to anything that I've ever done and decide that it was trash because of a little thing here, a little thing there. I would have done this differently. Oh, why didn't we do that? And I think that anyone could, you know. What I choose to do is decide that an album in the true sense of the word is an album, like a photo album. It's a collection of who you are at one point in time. And, you know, you don't go back to, you know, pictures when you were like 11 years old and you had a weird haircut and lament. It was like, oh man, why did I have that haircut? Oh my God, I'm going to lose sleep. No, I was 11 years old. I had a weird haircut, whatever. That was who I was at that point in time. The ink is dry. Move on. I try to do the best I can. I try to be very critical of myself in the moment. But I also know that if I don't release something because I'm waiting for it to be perfect, I'll never release anything. So you have to have a conversation with yourself. Say, is this who you are now? Is this the best you could do right now? Because if it is, let it go.
I think it was during one of your lockdown videos. I think you were talking about the importance of being in the moment and what comes out in the moment is that moment. So really get over anything that comes over and think ahead. And what's done has sort of gone off somewhere. And I think it jumped out really quickly to me that everything is actually in the moment. And you were saying at that moment, in the moment is only now, which is then gone.
Right. And if I'm stressing over something that happened in the past, well, you know, how much could I really do about that? Very, very little. Oh.
What advice would you give on that sort of thing? If you're improvising on stage, which you're doing all the time, the interaction with musicians, you obviously work collaboratively with loads and loads of musicians, but say you get together with a new group and you have a sound check because you're not going to get together for rehearsals, are you? Because you lot of dudes, you know the dots and you basically know where you're going. But how do you get this sort of gel very quickly? Or is it just something that evolves in the course of sound check and the gig?
It does. You know, it's interesting because I've done a lot of shows where, you know, like especially going overseas where it might not be feasible to bring seven people from the States for, you know, just a few shows. What I do try to do most of the time now is play with my band that, you know, we've developed into, you know, into mind readers. So it's lovely. But to your question, there's two ways to go about it. I mean, a lot of people will, you know, of course, you know, you send your music way ahead of time and, you know, they can see it, they can listen to it, you know, and by the time you get there, it's, you know, everyone kind of knows what's going on. There are some people who want to, you know, prescribe everything and say, okay, here, you know, that's not, you know, this is the bass part. Now this, I want you to play these, you know, very, very prescriptive. I want it to sound exactly like this. And I think that's really hard to do, to really get a group of strangers to get, even who share a very, very common vocabulary, to sound like a cohesive unit. My approach is, I've given you the broad strokes. This is the, these are the chords. This is the melody. This is the form. But you're all musicians. You're all professionals. You all have a point of view. You all have a voice. You all have a way of interpreting. So I want you to bring you as a human being and as a musician to the table here. I'm not going to, you know, tell you anything more than these are the chords. This is the groove. But like how you do that, you have a lot of latitude to interpret this. And if it goes far beyond what I believe is, you know, characteristic of the music, I will say, maybe let's bring it in a little bit. But I think allowing musicians to bring who they are to the table, the unit coalesces much more quickly and much more joyfully than if you're trying to get a bunch of people who you've never worked with before to conform to this idea, this preconceived notion that you have in your head of how it all should sound, opening yourself up to the possibility that you may hear something wonderful that you would have never thought of. And a song may take a form that you would have never thought of. And how cool could that be, right? So yeah, I always go through it with an open mind. And as long as everybody's prepared, it's a bit of an extra step, but it can be really fascinating, actually.
So it's real organic creation in that you plant the bulbs, so you don't scatter the seeds, but you plant the bulbs, and literally as the gig's going on, they're being watered and it's growing, and like ivy, them sort of gels and meshes together.
Yeah, and there's also this wonderful thing that musicians do almost better than anybody else. It's this nonverbal communication, but with such granularity, and I think just with body language and with facial expressions and line of sight. I mean, we telegraph so much to one another throughout the course of performance that, you know, minor adjustments and also inspirations and also kudos happen just in, you know, in situ. So, you know, it's an organic thing, as you mentioned. It does evolve, and we don't even have to say words. We can, you know, use all of those nonverbal cues that allow us to continue to create in the moment.
But the nonverbal things it's quite confusing for an audience, because you could be playing away, and then you'll get the eyes of, say, the guitar player, and then he'll start sort of something will happen that we just think that's really good, and then they'll start laughing or they'll start smiling. And then the drummer will start, and you think, what is this communication going on? What has caused that hilarity?
Yeah. And it could be as simple as like an eyebrow goes up. You know? I mean, seriously, I mean, like, you know, we don't necessarily, I mean, you can communicate so many things by not even opening your mouth, you know? Yeah. I think that's really kind of the fun of it. It's the universal kind of form of communication that allows this evolution to happen, you know, even in a short span of time.
So the illusion of what you're doing and what you're playing as a group is evolving. The communication you have with an audience, whether it be via vinyl, is sort of you're just getting the auditory experience of the music. When you play live, you're very keen on that interaction, verbal interaction with the audience, which creates that narrative to what they're going to be listening to.
Yeah.
You're really good at that. And it's really important for you to sort of create this sort of verbal bond, isn't it?
It's a bit of a mechanism to help me feel comfortable, to develop a rapport. You know, you walk into a room, which is why I like actually playing smaller clubs more so than large, you know, theaters or venues, because you walk into a place and you're playing for a bunch of strangers and you're putting yourself out there and hoping that they like what they hear. The more of a relationship that you develop, the more comfortable everybody becomes, and that becomes this thing that you're creating together. And everyone's in on the joke, you know? Like, you're not so isolated on the stage from everybody else. You're, you know, walking into a room full of strangers, and you know, being hesitant to start a conversation. But then after a while, you feel very comfortable with those people if there's some rapport that you develop and there's a conversation that happens. And it also just like frees you up to express yourself a little bit more, or even not take yourself so seriously all the time, or whatever. Just it makes it more fun, you know, more personal.
It does. And that, I suppose that's very different from the Steve Cole that was a classical player, where you didn't really need to introduce each piece, to what you're doing now, which it's almost, you're creating this sort of, as you say, this relationship where the audience is almost in on the whole piece. And we're following it because you've already described what's going to be coming up and the whole point of the whole, the narrative, the music.
And I don't think that it should necessarily be restricted to non-classical genres. So for instance, this was very, I mean, it was a little, so I played a classical recital not too long ago with a friend of mine who's just a marvelous saxophonist. His name is Preston Duncan, and he's the professor of saxophone at the University of Minnesota. He took over from the great Eugene Rousseau,
oh gosh,
who was a student of course, Marcel Mule, and you know, one of the, you know, kind of one of the American, you know, legs of the stool. It was Donald Cinta, Fred Hemke, Eugene Rousseau. And anyway, so we walked into the recital hall and he played a piece. Then we played a piece together, a duet. And then I came out and I was playing a piece that's very, very technically challenging. It was definitely a stretch for me. I'm going to take this on, and I'm actually going to perform it in front of people. And I walked out, and I remember, I forgot for a second that I was in a more formal environment. And I walked out, and I said, and I looked around and said, everybody all right so far? And then I looked at my accompanist. I said, how you doing? Are you good? You ready to light this candle? And then I looked back out, and I said, all right, cross your fingers, people. And then it was boom, off to the races.
Yeah, I love it.
And it was so non, many would feel it would be inappropriate for the environment, but you know what? I needed to do it for me because I needed to feel like I had a rapport, that I wasn't just standing there by myself, because I don't play a lot of classical recitals. I don't regularly find myself confined by the ink. And I just, you know, it was a way for me to feel like, hey, let's just do this thing. Let's be in this together. And it ended up wonderfully. I felt fabulous playing the piece. Maybe, you know, some people would be like, that's not, you know, that's not the way it should be done. But I don't know. I think ultimately we all had a great time.
And very quickly, before I finish on the last one, another question. Playing classical sax and jazz sax on the various genres, you need to change your sound and your tonal colors, just like flute players would do. If you look at the classical flute players, and you look at the great jazz flute players, there is a difference. I mean, I'm quite envious of sax players that play the flute because they have this dirty, naughty sound that is airy and sexy.
Yeah.
And I just can't do it. Mine's sort of too focused. How are you aware? Do you have to really struggle to stay in the sort of classical contemporary tonality rather than the sort of the freedom you have with the sounds when you're playing jazz?
Yeah, because I started out playing classical and developing that technique and that sound, that concept of sound, it's really at the core of all of my saxophone playing, in jazz or otherwise. And so I'm very conscious of the constraints, like most of the classical playing I do is on alto saxophone or soprano. I want it to be a very focused sound. I want it to be a very, very rich, but more civilized sound. Not so much, not so bright. You know, I want that beautiful core tone, right? So I'm conscious of that. But on the other hand, I can make myself sound classical on any mouthpiece. And I can make myself sound like a jazz player on any mouthpiece. So much of it is really here in the intention. I don't feel like it's too much of a stretch to go back and forth.
I mean, anyone who's heard you play know that you have a facility that must have come from the classical study, because your facility on that horn is just amazing.
Oh, thanks, man. I mean, and still lots of work to do. But I mean, again, going back to the fundamentals, going back to scales and etudes and, you know, just being very, very critical of cleanliness and tone and intonation. And it's weird. I mean, we don't get to make mistakes, really. I mean, the expectation, you know, a doctor, you know, you could be a surgeon and have gotten straight A's in medical school, but have gotten 94% on everything and still have gotten straight A's. And he's like, I'm a straight A student in medical school with a 94% average. Imagine playing any piece of music 94% correctly. It'd be a disaster.
Yeah.
Right? And this is the standard that we have to hold ourselves to. And it's not fair.
And that standard changes according to the perception of the person listening to it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, just in terms of, I'm going to play with a 94% good tone. Not going to be good. I'm going to play with 94% rhythmic accuracy. Not going to be rhythmically accurate. Right? Sorry, folks.
Steve, I know you're, I'm taking so much of your time here, but it's just wonderful talking to you. I have a question, and apologies for all of you that did send. I sent Steve a list of 16. I think I've covered three because we've deviated off so much.
I tend to be very long-winded on a saxophone player. Yeah,
one came in today, which I put up on socials. I was talking to you, and it was from a David Smithen from Texas, and he says, how does an up-and-coming musician begin to promote himself to a wider audience to try and get gigs? That's a hard one, isn't it? Because everybody's trying to get gigs.
Yeah. It all depends on what kind of gigs you want. I think that, you know, first of all, everyone needs to start locally. Everybody needs to start being, you know, being the biggest deal in their backyard. And what does that mean? That means making sure that your playing is ready for prime time, right? Making sure that you have something that you're proud of, that you're excited to share with an audience. Knowing that a gig as an artist, if you want to have your own gigs playing, you know, as the focus of attention, you have to develop something that's compelling musically, but also from a performance standpoint. And being out there in your community and being very, very well known, just as someone who supports other musicians, who shows up at other shows, who, you know, maybe gets the opportunity to sit in with other players. And when given the opportunity to play locally, it's something that, you know, doesn't have too many gatekeepers around it, that you play like you're playing at the Hollywood Bowl or at the Royal Albert Hall or wherever the big aspirational venue is. And that you realize that you're an entertainer as well as a musician and that you need to focus on both of those things. In terms of, you know, gaining a fan base to broaden that sphere, I think a lot of it is bringing something not only about, you know, the music that you play, but why you're doing this in the first place. I mean, I think a lot of developing a fan base is about communication, and it's about sharing. It's about what are you offering and how much can you learn about the people who might be interested in you, and how can you serve them with music, with content, with things that, you know, are of value to them. I mean, launching a career as an artist is like launching any other business. You know, there's that entrepreneurial approach. It's like, where are the opportunities? Where are the gaps in the market that I think that I can provide value to? Where are the pain points, right? And then how can I develop as much empathy as I possibly can with the people that I'm trying to serve and deliver something to them that's compelling and that's value-laden and that moves the needle for them? I think a lot of times we, as musicians, we say, all right, you know, I play music and I'm pretty good at it, so people should come and see me. It's like, that's not how it works, you know? Being very dedicated to developing a community of people by understanding what they need, what they're getting, what they're not getting, and how you can insert yourself into those gaps in a meaningful way. It's not easy. But I think that it starts with get those opportunities locally and hit it out of the park. You know, don't treat a local gig like a local gig. Treat it like any gig. Because it's not about geography. It's about what you're doing and what you're putting on stage and how much you have the audience in mind when you're putting your show, your product, your personality. And the other thing I think is really important is people don't respond to what you do. They respond to why you do it.
Yeah.
And I think that communicating your purpose as an artist is really important as well. Hey, I'm a great saxophone player and I have a great band. Come and see me play. And this isn't an original thing. This is this wonderful guy named Simon Sinek writes about this all the time and kind of, you know, the meaning of why and how meaning is such so much more powerful. It's more about, hey, you know, I have music I want to share with you. I want to bring something unique and personal, you know, to the stage. I hope you come and experience it with me. A much more compelling value proposition than, you know, just trying to be another one of many and try to compete for the same audience everybody else is competing for. But it takes a lot of cycles. It takes a lot of commitment. It takes a lot of relationship building, building a community of support around you with other creatives and other artists that can, you know, embolden and inspire one another. Being very present in your musical community, supporting other artists, showing up at other artists' shows, getting to know people, but also having your game together. So if you do get an opportunity, you know that, you know, it's your job now also to be a creative partner with the person who's giving you a stage. So you're as responsible as them for marketing and communication and social media and building awareness. And you're not just going to get a gig and then just hope people show up. These days, you've got to be part of the marketing department. So yeah, long involved question, answer to a very simple question, but that question is no longer simple.
It's not. And it's times like this where being a 94% straight A doctor, medical doctor, is sometimes preferable because you know what you're going to be doing. And also, it's almost a full circle thing, Steve, because it goes back to then, as long as you know who you are as a musician and you've found your own voice, as you started out most eloquently at the beginning, the route map that you have to begin. And it all comes down to, as you said, collaboration. It all comes down with turning up on time. It all comes with being friendly. It all comes with study. It all comes with listening. And there isn't one answer, but you've managed to squeeze that into a most fantastic answer. And I could continue talking to you, but I know you are very busy, Hector. So I would like to say, on behalf of all the listeners of Talking Flutes, thank you to Dr. Steve Cole. Thank you, Steve, for coming on. And I know you're a doctor, so I have to put that in. My daughter's just got a past her doctorate in forensic psychology, and it's quite weird calling someone doctor, isn't it, when you know them by their first name? Just like I know you were Steve, but...
I'm Steve. My students call me doctor, but nobody else does. Plus, I mean, you know, I can't really cure anything. I can, if you have an existential crisis, I could probably add something to that. But, I mean, you know, doctor, really?
No, you work hard for that. So, Steve, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being a guest. And thank you for all you flute players that asked for a guest to come on that wasn't a flute player that could take us on a different journey. And Steve has done that. He very rarely mentioned saxophone, which is brilliant because everything he's spoken about is relevant to us as musicians, us as flute players. And even if you're not a flute player, you're a clarinet player or a singer, it's still relevant. So thank you, Steve. Thank you for your time.
No, thanks for the opportunity. This has been a wonderful conversation.
And let's catch up again, hopefully in person, and they're not too distant. A nice cold beer would be good.
Yeah, yeah. Agreed.
And thank you all for listening this week to Talking Flutes with me, Jean-Paul Wright. May your week ahead be musically fulfilling, and may your low C be especially in tune, because mine never is. Goodbye, all. Thank you.
Talking Flutes and Talking Flutes Extra are podcast productions by the Trevor James Flute Company. For more information, visit trevorjamesflutes.com.